Of Locking Heads. I am one of your two hosts, Ezra Klein, and I'm joined by the impressive Will Wilkinson. Hi, Will.
Hi, Ezra. How are you doing?
I'm good. Before we get into our many points of disagreement, you and I agree on one of the foundational issues, I think, of at least modern international relations, mm-hmm. right? And that is that Ben's Chili Bowl is not where Nicolas Sarkozy should have eaten yesterday.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yesterday, Sarkozy and his wife, what's her name?
Carla Bruni. The beautiful and talented Carla Bruni.
Yeah, the beautiful and talented Carla Bruni, ex model. They're in Washington D.C. and they go to Ben's Chili Bowl on U Street, which is, very close to my heart. That is, in fact, the place where I had my first extended conversation with my fiance, so it's I'm sentimental about it, but it somehow always political figures are always going there, and I just felt like it needed to be said that the food's not really great. So I tweeted that last night, and it was I think it's maybe the most controversial thing I've ever tweeted.
It should not be controversial. I mean, Ben's Chili Bowl is an important D.C. institution. It is part of the soul of the city. It has made it through thick and thin with D.C. It has played host to all sorts of different types of inhabitants. And, I mean, I couldn't have more respect for what it has meant to my town.
Yeah.
The food there is terrible. It's not great. It's just not good. It's primarily beloved by drunk people who are not discerning as to whether or not the chili is coming out of a can. It is just not a great place to eat food if you're in Washington, D.C. I actually think U Street is worse for eating than people tend to give it credit for, mm-hmm. but that doesn't make Ben's Chili Bowl better. It's bad. You'd do much better hoofing it up to Adams Morgan and eating at Amsterdam Falafel.
Yeah, I agree. But that's not popular. I don't know why it is that I love the institution as well. I'm sentimental about it, but it's just okay. And people somehow get heated about this question, which is interesting. An establishment has to be good along every dimension if you're going to sort of value it. But the half smoke, it's the best thing there. If you go there, get that.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But I'm not the gastronome that you are, Ezra. So I was glad to have your concurrence because I'm not very confident in my assessments of the quality of cuisine.
I'm happy to stand with you. I've written about this on the food blog, the Internet Food Association, and I think again Ben's Chili Bowl. I think it is a lovely place, and may it live for 1,000 years. But you'll never catch me saying, you know what, given the manifold options available to me in D.C., I'm off to Ben's Chili Bowl. Although the one thing I'll say is, talking about this does make me think that maybe actually Ben's Chili Bowl is exactly where tourists should go. That mm-hmm. in that sense, maybe the way we entered this conversation was dead wrong. Obviously, Nicolas Sarkozy comes from France. He can eat good food often. He's a president of probably the best food country, or one of the best food countries on earth. So to come to D.C. and eat maybe not good food, but go somewhere that has more of a connection to the sort of soul of the city, maybe that actually is a terrific idea. And I was I had that wrong when
I think
came into this.
I think that sounds right to me. That's why you should have gone there. It's because it's important to the culture of the city. It's not the food. But speaking of beloved Washington, D.C. institutions, let's talk about Congress.
Let's talk about Congress. I don't know if you saw this before we get into my article. The Onion, I thought, had a nice piece today where it said in an important cost-cutting measure, Barack Obama and the White House are going to save $300 billion by shutting down their senator program.
Yeah, the expensive senator program. Yeah, I
which
like
is,
that.
Which doesn't appear to be helping anyone, they said.
Yeah, no, that was
so
right. Good.
So I have this big piece on Congress in Newsweek, which is sort of a longer form version of arguments I've been making for a while on the blog and in a different fora. And the argument of this piece is not just sort of just that Congress is paralyzed by the filibuster or whatever, but to sort of try to make clear to people that there are certain consequences to letting the institution work as poorly as it currently does. And among them, certainly what I argued at the beginning of the piece, is an increased amount of offloading of responsibilities, what I call the outsourcing of government. So you see this on pretty much every issue, where Congress has had to sort of take on something big, and they have in turn attempted to create a sort of Congress doesn't work escape hatch.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare reform. The really big decisions on healthcare reform, the things that will ensure Medicare solvency, the government solvency, have been shunted off to this independent commission called the Independent Payment Advisory Board.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, a lot of liberals and a lot of members of Congress are hoping that, you know, if Congress can act on cap and trade, that the EPA will take over. You have the Deficit Commission, which Kent Conrad and Judd Gregg, the co-chairs of the Senate Budget Committee, wanted to create because they felt their committee wasn't up to it, which then got filibustered to death, and the president created a Deficit Commission on his own. And you can sort of keep going on down the line. Obviously, Congress's role in foreign affairs is very, very weak at this point in time. And I know I'm forgetting one of my examples from the piece. And on the other hand, when they do things due to the sort of prevalence of the filibuster, they are using a lot of rules that don't make a lot of sense in order to make the place function. So obviously the filibuster is being applied to a lot of things, and the secondary issue with that is not just that you need 60 votes, but that to break a filibuster takes about a week of floor time,
mm-hmm.
because it's 2 days to wait for cloture to what's called ripen, and then 30 hours of post-cloture debate. You can call a filibuster on multiple parts of a vote. So you're, one, wasting a lot of time there, but then in order to get around the filibuster, you're seeing Democrats and Republicans alike resort to the budget reconciliation process, which means you have to write your bills such that the parliamentarian says, yeah, that's all budget-related, which may not be the best way to achieve what you're attempting to achieve, either at the lowest possible cost or at the highest efficiency or whatever it is. So the point of the piece is really that, you know, even though you're seeing something big like healthcare reform move, which I obviously think is a good thing, that there's still a problem here in Congress, and I don't think it's working in a way that people should be pleased about or content with.
Yeah. Well, can we back up a second and talk
about
Well, because as the healthcare reform debate was going on, you wrote a lot about how Congress and our politics is dysfunctional, and a lot of that seemed to be driven by frustration with the fact that this big piece of legislation that is seen by you know, at least half the country as being incredibly necessary, that it might not even get through, and that the process was sort of being continually delayed. And that pointed to a certain kind of dysfunction within our political institutions. But I'm not sure that I agree with that premise. I'm not sure that it's hard to say. I think that our institutions could be much better designed. But I don't tend to think that that if the process is slow, or that if there are super majoritarian requirements, that is a sign of dysfunction. I actually think it's a sign that things are working relatively well. And maybe we can get more into that as we talk about some of the issues about sort of polarization that seem to have something to do with the way the rules in Congress, you know, got to be the way that they are. So I just wanted to back up and talk a little
sure.
bit about the context of whether or not the system is broken. And I understand your piece as being, saying that, okay, even though healthcare reform did in the end pass, the biggest priority for Democrats in the Democratic Congress, even though we finally managed to get it through, that doesn't show that Congress is healthy.
Well, one thing that I'd say, and the reason it was important to me to write this piece after healthcare reform passed, was because, as you say, I think the sense is that, you know, the frustration of a lot of people has to do with healthcare reform, which certainly I think that awoke a lot of frustration in a lot of people. But two things. One, the solution I've always favored, the solution I bring up at the end of the piece, has not been to just sort of change the filibuster rule somehow unilaterally. I think that there should be a a sort of a bipartisan commission that sets rules that will go into effect 6 or 8 years from now, and we don't know who's in charge. I actually think it's somewhat problematic to try to impose new rules on the other side. Which is not to say if it ends up happening that I won't support it, but it is not the path I prefer to see people going down. So I want to be clear on that, mm-hmm. that it is true that I think frustration came out of in part health care,
yeah.
But that the solutions that I and many others have argued for have to do with a long-term question of how the body works, as opposed to a short-term intervention into a particular debate. And a lot of the way I've tried to write this and talk about this has been attempting to make what, as you say, is a difficult distinction to make. And then the second thing, which I'm not trying to remember what it was, but presumably had to do something with healthcare in the Congress. I don't know. That was the point I was going to make on that anyway.
Yeah. Especially for conservatives and maybe and limited government types generally, part of the concern with procedural amendments is that historically in the 20th century, the changes that have come about to the structure of congressional deliberation tend to have been things that enable the ability of Congress to pass big initiatives. Or even outside the U.S., the constitutions that were, written in Europe after World War II have a kind of parliamentary structure that makes large-scale redistribution simply politically easier than it is in the United States. One of the things that I think limited government types and people who are generally skeptical of a greater deal of redistribution kind of like some of the counter-majoritarian aspects of the American constitutional structure and the way the Senate works and so forth. Mm-hmm. So there's a general. I'm not saying whether this is right or wrong, but I think that's part of the source of a wariness of trying to make procedural changes, because there's just this suspicion that the point of the procedural changes is to make it easier for sort of one side of the nation's political debate to get their way. And I understand that's not what you're saying, but that is, I think, where some of the suspicion comes from.
I understand the suspicion, and I would say obviously in the Republican era, Bill Frist attempted to make the biggest change in the filibuster, shutting it down for nominations or judicial nominations that we've seen in a while. And also, and this gets to the other point I meant to make and forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the concern about Congress comes because something has actually changed, right? And this is, I think, a really important part of this debate. If you look at a graph of how often the filibuster is used, it looks like this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't really see that on the thing, but it looks like that. It really has gone from being a very rare occurrence, usually used on civil rights legislation, to being an everyday constant occurrence, which is consuming time in the chamber. If you want to ask why, for instance, the executive branch is still missing, whatever it is, 80 nominations and being wary to propose many others for the open slots that they have, it's because, if everything's going to get a cloture vote called on it, you just don't have time to do them.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't. And that's why 15 recess nominations going the other day. So one thing that we do have to account for is that the way Congress is functioning has fundamentally, very fundamentally changed.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say that change is for the better.
Yeah.
Or you can say it's for the worse. I believe it's for the worse. But I think that what we need to be careful with in this conversation is to admit that we're in a reality different than, say, 50 years ago. And decide if we think that reality is the right reality to be in, if we think this context is the right context for Congress to work in. If not, then we can talk about changing if we think it's, it evolved this way for a good reason.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough. But it isn't just that there are people who want to change the way it works. As one of those people, I would say that there are people who think the way it works has changed,
mm-hmm.
and want to actually move towards changing it back. The evidence I always use on this, a reader of mine was doing some research in, I think it was the Lyndon Johnson library, and he found a memo written by Mike Manassas, who was Johnson's liaison to the Senate. And Manassas wrote to Johnson right after the 64 election, and he said, look, we've picked up 5 supporters for Medicare. If the bill was to come to the floor today, we would win 55-45.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, at that point, obviously, whoever was running the Senate side of things for Johnson knew a lot about how the Senate worked. It didn't occur to them that they couldn't pass anything. And at that point, you would have needed 67 votes to break a filibuster, so it would have been much easier.
Mm-hmm.
But so things were actually working differently than they did at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important to decide if we think they're working right or working wrongly.
Yeah.
But we're not in a static situation here, and people want to change the rules from operating the way they've always been operating.
Yeah. Well, I've got two things to say about that. One, I think that the thing that I think and agree is definitely a big problem has to do with appointments and the process for the president has the right to make these appointments for the executive branch bureaucracy but on the condition that they're vetted by the Senate, and that process has become ridiculous, right? And for the government to function the way it should, you need it to be staffed. And you need those political appointees to be able to get into position and to start doing their work. So I think there's a real problem there, and I would like there to be reform of that issue in particular. I'm not sure that the ability to delay legislation is such a problem. One thing that you mentioned that it used to be harder to break a filibuster.
Right. I mean, there's a period when you couldn't do it at all.
Yeah. And we're seeing more of them now. I mean, to me, it just stands to reason that the easier it is to break a filibuster, the more filibusters you'll have. If it was impossible to break a filibuster, then if I'm, a senator from, Wyoming or something, and I can credibly convince the other party that I will filibuster unless they agree to come to the table and bargain with me, then they'll come to the table and bargain with me because my threat is credible. I can shut down the entire effort just by myself. When it becomes easier to break filibusters, you don't have it's less of a powerful tool to threaten them. And it becomes, as you were saying, more of a timing issue. It's a way for the minority party to have some control over the number of different issues that come on the agenda in any legislative session. And I'm not sure that that's a bad thing. It makes the majority party prioritize in a way that they might not otherwise do, and simply have giving the minority party that kind of power to have some effect of what comes or how many things get on the agenda. I think it's healthy.
I think it is an uncommon way of seeing what the minority is doing to say that they are trying to exert control of how many items go on the agenda. One of the points I make in the piece and the point that really sort of underlies my thinking on this is that it seems to me that you can run a political system either with the incentive for the minority to see the majority fail or the power to make them fail, but not both. But what we do know, and we've seen in election after election in 06 and 94 are very good examples, and we're going to see this again, or at least it was attempted in 2010, is that minorities have recognized that what really looks bad for the majority party is to fail with their agenda, to not pass anything. And, people like Newt Gingrich and Mitch McConnell have made this point very, very straightforwardly. And certainly Democrats did a lot of this themselves in 05 and 06. And if the filibuster were used, I think the way it is sort of in the model you're implying here, mm-hmm. where the minority is trying to keep a hand in the cookie jar, that would be one thing. But if the filibuster is being used to win the next election by making it seem like Washington is dysfunctional, and so instead the minority runs because Congress isn't acting,
mm-hmm.
and of course the American people, most of them don't. There's a recent poll by Pew. 25% of people can tell you how many votes it takes to end a filibuster. Another 25% thinks it's a simple majority, and the rest don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So about half of the people don't know, and then another 25% are wrong. So you have a situation there where you can use a filibuster not just for the minority to make sure that it has a role, which I think is sort of the idealized way that it would be used to slow things down and say, listen, we're here too and you got to talk to us. But instead to make it seem like something is going terribly wrong in Washington, mm-hmm. that action is not being taken on public priorities, and that, you know, you should throw these bums out and bring these new guys in so they can clean the place up a little bit and make things work for the American people again. Then, of course, the minority party does it to them. Evan Bayh, sort of all people, mm-hmm. put a very nice line on this, and he said, powers being won in a manner, I'm paraphrasing him here, but powers being won in a manner that makes exercising power nearly impossible.
Yeah, I think
by the way, you could argue that that's good. I think folks who don't want to see the government doing much might like that.
Yeah.
But it's not just that the minority is trying to have a voice here. They're trying to win the next election.
Yeah, well, of course. The minority is trying to win the next election. Whether that applies to the healthcare debate is not clear to me. I mean, trying to win the next election obviously applies. But the Republican strategy didn't strike me as one of trying to convey to the public the idea that Washington is unable to get anything done. It was clearly an obstructionist effort, right? The assumption was that unless we do something, this big thing will be done, and the majority of Americans don't want it done. You know, I think they're trying to win the next election, but I think it's partly because they see the poll numbers, think that healthcare reform really isn't very popular, and that they can ride opposition to the legislation into big victories in the next cycle. So I don't think they were trying to give the sense that Washington doesn't work. They were trying to show that they're principled in standing up to this, this malicious socialist, you know, grandma-killing scheme.
Sure, but this is why I think it's important to have this not entirely in the context of healthcare reform, mm. just because this year you had something very unique, which was 60 Democratic senators. So obviously the Republican strategy was born out of some amount of necessity there.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't argue that, you know, they couldn't just stop everything because they simply didn't have the votes to do it. It turned out that there was sort of extraordinary unanimity on both sides, but a very sort of a rare election cycle where Democrats got something neither party's had since 1975, if I remember correctly. So I think that's part of that, too. But, you know, and you're right, you know, it's obviously not that the only way these things are done is that way. But, I mean, the way the filibuster ends up working, for instance, one thing that Republicans did use very delightedly was the Nelson deal, right? But why did we have the Nelson deal? Well, we had the Nelson deal because there was a filibuster which forced Democrats to get 60 votes and gave the 60s vote entire power of the thing. If you had had a majority vote, there would have been no Nelson deal. So the way these things end up being used as part of it is, I think, you know, to make Washington work poorly. And that's the point I make in the piece, that it's not just about one issue or another, but you're seeing a systematic deterioration of the way Washington works. Some ways that make it less popular, some ways that make it less effective, and some ways that make it less accountable. And so it isn't just about whether or not healthcare reform passes. Healthcare reform is passed. It's done.
Mm-hmm.
And in the future, my prediction is what you're going to see is a lot more reconciliation, because I think the lesson for both parties this year has been that unless you got 60 votes, you are not getting anything serious for the normal order. That is almost impossible to do. So people are going to write their things to reconciliation, which to my thing should actually worry libertarians and conservatives a lot, because what reconciliation does is say everything you do has to be on the government's budget.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it through the private market. You can't really do private public hybrids. You can't put down regulations to try to move the market in your direction. You just got to do it straight, which makes, you know, so to speak, single-payer outcomes, not just for healthcare, but for pretty much everything, much likelier. But my strong suspicion is that for both parties moving forward now, that there's, you know, whatever hopes once existed that, you know, after a new president or in a new Congress, you would be able to get bipartisan accord on things are pretty much gone, that the polarization of the system is now so advanced that the idea that you can run anything without 60 votes is going to be considered pretty much a fantasy.
Let's talk a little bit more about polarization, because this comes up a lot,
sure.
And you were, you know, it was kind of a central issue in this exchange that you were mm-hmm. having with John Sides at the Monkey Cage political science blog. And it's interesting. So you mention in your article, but I don't know that a lot of people know it, that Congress over the past few decades has become increasingly polarized, and what that means is that the you know, more or less the average Republican representative or congressman is further to the right than they were before, and the average Democratic Congress person is further to the left than they were before. In previous decades, there was more clustering around the median, but now the representatives seem to be more distributed more heavily toward the extreme ends of the ideological scale. And there's some debate among political scientists about whether congressional polarization reflects polarization in the American electorate or not.
Right.
And I think that's an important question. And a couple of things that come to mind about polarization was that, you know, it's a lot worse than it was in Congress, but it's not complete. And one of the reasons why healthcare reform was so difficult for the Democrats to pass is that it's, you know, it's not total. That there are more conservative Democrats than there are liberal Republicans, and the conservative Democrats are, you know, in a position where if they vote for an unpopular bill in their relatively conservative district, you know, they face defeat at the polls. So so a lot of the effort in bringing getting health care reform passed was bringing conservative Democrats into the, you know, majority fold, and that wasn't easy. So greater polarization would have made it easier for the Democrats to pass the bill that they wanted. But also, like, there's this question about, and I'm not sure. I'm torn looking at the data about whether the electorate is more polarized or isn't. But if it's true that there is a greater level of ideological polarization in the population, then that's the kind of fact that makes me want, or makes me think, that the legislative process shouldn't be this cut and dry majoritarian process. Partly because that the disagreement on any issue that comes up for legislation is likely to be more intense. And I think the intensity of people's opposition to a particular piece of legislation ought to count, not just the numbers. And the way that that the intensity of preferences counts is the bargaining that all of the Nebraska kickback or whatever you call it, a Louisiana purchase, yada yada. I mean, those things, you can see them as a kind of corruption, but you can also see them as part of a dynamic process wherein the intensity of different kinds of preferences are getting taken into account. That in order to get my vote on this issue, you're going to have to give me something in return so that the interests of my constituents are aren't totally, you know, rolled over. That we're going
to. Well, I don't know.
Go ahead.
I don't know about that. I actually think the deals got blown out of proportion. I think that's how Congress has always worked, and I think we're gonna regret if we really rule this out of bounds. One important thing here is that there is some debate among political scientists over whether or not polarization is happening in the country as well. But definitely, there's no debate that it's much, much, much more intense among parties. And the reason is the parties have changed. So it used to be obviously that the Democrats had the Dixiecrats, which was a party of Southern racists within their party, and then of course Republicans had Northern liberals. Folks like. All the sort of the famed Republicans who voted for civil rights, but also who were there for Medicare and for many other things that no Republican would ever think of supporting. And so as parties aligned ideologically, that became a huge difference in helping pull them apart, because when parts of your party didn't believe the same thing, it was a lot harder to achieve unanimity in any particular direction, either for obstruction or for advancement.
Yeah.
And so the coalitions are much more shifting and much stranger, and party discipline is much weaker. And now that that's over, and, you know, you actually have a much closer amount of sort of cooperation internally to the parties. And a lot of people believe that actually there's been very, very little polarization in the country among this time. I mean, if you think of the polarization that was around something like civil rights, you know, what we're seeing now is almost polarization of small differences comparatively. And then the final thing that, you know, I think is hard to account for here is that congressional polarization can be driven by voters, but it can also go the other way too, right? If you're a Republican or you're a Democrat, and the people you trust in Congress and the people who are associated with people you trust in Congress, for Republicans talk radio and Fox News, Democrats MSNBC and, you know, some blogs and whatever else, if those forces polarize and decide as a strategy or decide as a matter of ideology or whatever it may be, that they are going to make this into a very sort of a hardline issue, that will change the way that their sort of followers react. And Mitch McConnell said this. I quote him in the article saying this, but he said this very clearly a couple weeks ago in the National Journal. He basically said, look, if John Boehner and I hadn't done what we did in really unifying Republican opposition to not just health care reform, but the bank bailouts and, you know, everything else, we don't think that the public would have become as angry as they became. And that you really do have something where people take their cues from American politics. You know, they look up, and if a bunch of Republicans, you could have imagined, I'm not saying it should have happened, but given where the Republican Party was on health care 10 or 15 years ago, or considering that 13 Republicans voted for the single-payer Medicare system, you could have imagined Republicans going and saying, look, you know, you're really building this thing around private insurers. We think we can work with this. And if 15 or 20 of them would come over and said, this is a pretty good bill, we can work on this, you got it, you know, you got our votes, put in more tort reform, HSAs. I'm not saying a conservative should want that to happen, but I think it would have changed the way the country looked at the bill. But so long as it's going to be a strategy to polarize, and it is on both sides, and it's very, very evident, I think that mucks up questions of, you know, how do you handle the intensity of the intensity of a voter feeling, because if the intensity of voter feeling is totally manipulable,
I think that
then you're essentially saying, you know, there's very little we can do, because you just have to wait for people to manipulate it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, there is this very complicated kind of dialectical dance between elite and popular opinion, and definitely, like, Fox News has the ability to move opinion, but the part of what I was trying to say. So let me say something more about the polarization in the population kind of issue. I don't think it's driven entirely by the strategy of the, you know, the elites in both parties.
I don't think it's entire, I should say.
So, and I do think I do think that there's significant polarization. This actually connects to what we are going to talk about next. As I've been looking a lot at surveys about value change around the world, but in particular in the U.S. And the U.S. is a weird place. This political scientist Ronald Engelhardt does this thing called the World Value Survey, and they look at, you know, over 30 years of poll data, and he's developed a general theory based on the trends that they see in the data, and there's like two big different dimensions of value change over time. One of them is the dimension from sort of traditional values to sort of what they call secular rational values. And then there's this other dimension, which goes from what they call survival values to self-expressive or emancipative values. The U.S. is weird in the sense that it is by far the most traditional of any developed economy. It's very far along on the self-expressive values dimension, but it's stagnant. It's not moving on the traditional to secular rational dimension. And I think the fact that those things are pulling apart, that we're getting movement on, and the self-expression dimension, it has to do with things like a sense of people's the importance of individuals being able to sort of express their personalities, or the importance of finding a job that's meaningful to you, or to live in a way that like expresses your personal individual values. So it increases a kind of individualism that is about sort of the importance of self-realization, but also about tolerance and fairness and so on. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're seeing is that people on the liberal side of the equation in the U.S., they've been moving along. Their trajectory has been basically like the trajectory of most European countries. They're becoming more secular, rational, and more self-expressive at the same time. The Americans on the sort of conservative side of the equation have hunkered down on a certain kind of traditional notion of family, of faith, of love of country. And I think there is this increasing polarization. It's not about economic issues so much as about culture. It's about like who we are and what we stand for. And I do think that there is this widening gulf in that sense. The question that's interesting historically is how it is that certain sort of economic views have gotten associated with American traditionalism. So how is it that opposition to government financing of medical care has been folded into this traditional notion of American identity? And I think a lot of the opposition to Democrats, something like a single payer healthcare plan, that seems rational, right? Like these are people with high secular rational values. This seems like a not only fair and just, but it seems like a responsible and an effective way to administer this kind of system. But for the opponents to it, it's basically that this isn't part of our American identity. This is not the way we do things. And it's hard for me to really think through like how to think about polarization when it's in those terms, when it's one side trying to put in place what they think of as good technocratic policy and the other side trying to defend a traditional notion of American identity. It's hard to know how you're supposed to take those two things and lead to and get legislation that represents a compromise. Anyway, I talked too long.
I think polarization is very difficult to think through, and how to incorporate into the way you think about what should be done is very difficult. The only point I would make on that, in terms of, you know, whether or not something like single payer is an affront to American identity, certainly things are in these terms. I've long thought that discussions of whether America is a center-right or center-left country ideologically mm-hmm. are bedeviled mm-hmm. by a certain amount of a first variable that we have a small c conservative government structure, mm-hmm. and then number two, obviously there's status quo bias in all sorts of things. So to give one example, right, one thing that always comes up in this, and you brought it up too, is that a lot of European countries have single payer or some type of nationalized healthcare system, and at least until recently, that we don't have single payer, we didn't. What we had, of course, was Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And so you ask yourself, well, why didn't we have one of what the Europeans had? And one answer to that is that we're different than they are. And then another answer to that is that actually six or seven or eight presidents had won elections promising to bring that.
Mm-hmm.
And that our system consciously, you know, even putting the filibuster aside, has many, many, many more veto points and many, many, many more impediments to action than those other countries do. So where those other countries had a president get elected on that platform and then they passed that bill, in our country that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And when that, in the case where it did happen, which is Medicare, it turns out that there's no affront to American values, that not only are Americans pretty happy with Medicare, but Republicans spent a lot of the last couple months saying Medicare is, you know, a sacrosanct element of American public policy and we will not let you cut it. You know, so that became so much part of America that even the conservative party was saying, by God, you will not touch Medicare.
Yeah.
So the question of what would happen if we had a different system, I think, is a tricky one and certainly needs to be considered in terms of this. But the one other final point I make on this, and I want to let you have the last word on this and then move to other bits of your research on the subject, is that because it is we have a tendency to talk about counter-majoritarianism questions in American public, in American government structure, in terms of very, very, very big issues.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the points I tried to make in the piece is that it isn't just about that. That I think something doing something like healthcare reform is always going to be very hard.
Mm-hmm.
Doing something like partial privatization of Social Security is always going to be very hard. These are big things, and it's very possible that you know you're not going to have you know the you want to have 51 folks from either side on them.
Mm-hmm.
That you couldn't have done reconciliation, for instance. We thought that might happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that you know that is necessarily where you're seeing the most of it. So the point I try to make is that this is actually affecting government in a lot of much smaller ways.
Mm-hmm.
That you're seeing things that you're not watching get outsourced to other agencies or less accountable, that much of the financial crisis response happened in the Federal Reserve to a really unprecedented degree where they were spending money just to buy up security, something you would have naturally thought Congress would do,
right.
But Congress couldn't, you know, didn't want to handle that. That was the example I'd forgotten. You know, where you're having, you know, the time, you're having the fact that you can waste time with the filibuster, as opposed to you can't have the votes, but just it would take a week to block Senator Jim DeMint's single-man filibuster on a nominee. So you're just not going to have an assistant secretary of domestic finance for nine months or 14 months. And that I just think that we really need to consider whether or not the way this is working is the right way. There are ways you could structure it such at very big issues. You know, whatever, there's still a high majoritarian requirement. Maybe you just take away the week-long thing to break a filibuster you can break. Maybe you just end the wait around that and accept that filibusters aren't about lengthening debate anymore, but about imposing a supermajority requirement. Obviously, I would move more in the more majoritarian direction, but I just don't think – I think there's a lot in here that folks of both parties should be concerned about if they want an efficient government, even putting that question aside, whether or not you want more majoritarianism or an easier glide path for big changes.
Yeah. I mean, just real quickly on congressional rules.
Please.
But part of my suspicion is that the de facto congressional rules that we have them partly because they're kind of a bargain that's already been hammered out by the two parties, given the changing structure of the American electorate and the changing structure and composition of Congress, and such that like having a commission. To think about things differently might end up giving you something that's not too different from what we have in the first place.
Very well might.
Speaking to this deeper issue, you mentioned how conservatives were defending Medicare as you know part of American identity. That's an important point. That there's something kind of arbitrary about conservatism. It's like you're just conserving whatever you happen to have. But I think that also points to why. The debates over entitlements are so fraught. The political preferences are, you know, as the economists say, are endogenous to the institutions, that what people want partly depends on what institutions that they already have. And entitlements are a really important case of this, that they tend to generate their own demand if you can get them into place. And this has a lot to do, I mean, when I was arguing for Social Security privatization, one of the reasons that I want it and why I think a lot of others want it is because it would give all Americans a bigger stake in the performance of the American economy, and that creates political pressure in favor of economic growth and policies that promote it and against policies that tend to stymie it, and I think that would be healthy. But you're trying to – that's moot. I mean, by giving people private accounts for Social Security, you're changing the nature of the entire debate about American economic policy, right? So that's got a big consequence. And similarly with things like Medicare or things like health care, once people have gotten an entitlement, they just – they internalize that that's where this comes from, that where I get my – retirement pension from is the government. Where I get my medical care from is from the government. And people are kind of conservative. They're just loss averse and are very wary of changing that structure once it's in place. So I think a lot of the vehemence of the debate over things like health care partly reflects that changing entitlements like that is changing what I like to call America's de facto constitution, that it really is a fundamental change in the basic structure of our political institutions.
Yeah, I think those are all fair points. And since I got to run in a couple minutes, why don't we talk about your about your, speaking of changing values, why don't we talk about some changing
values?
Yeah,
sure. So while I've been doing some of this research on value change, I was in the World Value Survey. I made a little chart of changing attitudes towards homosexuality. I can hold it up. I don't know if it will be legible at all, but we'll put.
I can't see it. Will.
Yeah, we'll put a link to it. And what it shows is this precipitous decline in the percentage of the population in a bunch of developed countries. The World Value Survey offers this question that is on a scale of 1 to 10 that asks you whether certain behaviors are how justifiable they are. They're either always justifiable, which is 1. Never justifiable, 10, or maybe it goes the other way around. And I was looking at the percentage of the populations who said that homosexuality is never justifiable as a proxy for the sort of tolerance of the society toward homosexuality. And there's been a huge drop over the last 30 years, last 25 years, mm-hmm. In every developed market liberal democracy. And it was interesting, just putting up this fact, a lot of people reproduced the chart. Andrew Sullivan, Dan Savage, people with a special interest in issues about tolerance toward gay and lesbians. The one thing that sticks out to people on the chart is that in the United States, the trend is pretty uniform, going from about 1980 to about 2000. It just drops from 60-some percent to about 31%. But since 2000, between 2000 and 2006, the percentage of the population saying that homosexuality is never justifiable has increased slightly to 35%. And a number of people were looking at the graph and thinking that showed that the United States, the trend in the United States was sort of exceptional, that we're kind of going backwards on that issue. But what I think it actually shows, and this is just what I wanted to say as a clarification of the chart, it doesn't show that the U.S. is slipping backwards. What it does show is some increasing polarization on the issue. So what this Right. what this chart shows is one end of a continuum of attitudes. The percentage of people saying that homosexuality is always justified has been continually increasing, and has increased in the last period, even when the people who said it's never justifiable went up. And I think part of the reason you have an uptick is that the issues become more salient, with gay marriage on the table as a real political issue. You know, we have it here in Iowa. You have it there in Washington, D.C. That has created a lot of energy in certain conservative Christian groups, and has sort of consolidated their opposition to not just to gay marriage, but to tolerance for homosexuals in general. But I think that uptick is actually part of that's a last gasp. But that's the last we're going to hear of it for some time. And that I think the U.S. is going to end up looking sort of like Sweden on the chart, which now has 4% of the population says that homosexuality is never justifiable. You know, I think we'll get there eventually. But I think we're having a little bit of an upsurge in intolerance due to the salience of the gay marriage issue.
See, it seems very possible to me. I mean, another way to put it that the political scientists might use is that, they sort of think there are three ways that issues interact. People's beliefs on issues interact with politicians, right? One is that you have an issue, you think gay marriage is very bad, mm-hmm. and you look for politicians who agree with you. And another is that you know which politicians you agree with, and you look for what their position is on the issue, and you adopt it as your own.
Yes.
Then a third is that you have that you look at politicians and they persuade you of issues, right? Mm-hmm. So there's projection, persuasion, and then whatever pre-existing. And you're probably seeing some of all of that here. But what I would suggest is that the preeminence of it in the political debate. I'm just looking at this chart, and it ends around 05-06, and the sharp sort of move is between sort of the early aughts in 05-06, which strike me as a period in which there was a particular amount of particularly the 04 election, talk about gay marriage. Mm-hmm. I imagine a lot of people who, if it hadn't entered into the political discussion in a very serious way, wouldn't have had a very strong feeling on this, learned or decided they had very, very strong feelings maybe they didn't recognize before, probably on both sides.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's part of how politics polarizes.
Yeah, yeah. And what you see is, because it is a continuum from 1 to 10, you see, you know, mostly the whole chart, you know, dropping toward always justifiable. But there's a lot of movement away from the middle, that a lot of people have kind of crossed the middle into the sort of faintly positive, but the people who are already in the negative side have sort of moved to the extreme of negativity. But that's
right. The center does not hold.
But the center does not hold. Well, I think our time's up, and I think we both applaud this this general trend toward greater tolerance. But it's just another example of the way polarization sort of affects the political system.
Absolutely. Well, Will, thank you so much as always. It is an enlightening conversation for me.
Likewise. Take care, Ezra. And congratulations on
easy.
The Newsweek.
And thank you, and don't eat a Ben's Chili Bowl.
All right. Take care, man.
Cheers.